were true, and surely many, most, of them believed the events that they narrate really happened. The Gospel of Pseudo-Matthew. The same can be said of the stories found in the Gospel of Pseudo-Matthew. It is called this because it was thought in the Middle Ages to have been written by Matthew himself. Originally, however, the book was a heavily reworked version of the Proto-Gospel. It, too, claimed to have been written by Jesus' half-brother James. Among the more interesting accounts of this narrative are the miracles Jesus performs when the Holy Family flees to Egypt after his birth. We learn, for example, that en route they stop to rest outside a cave. To the terror of Joseph and Mary, out of the cave come a troop of dragons. The 2-year-old Jesus, however, is not the least bit afraid. He waddles and stands before the fearsome beasts. When they see who he is, they bow down and worship before him. The author tells us that this fulfilled the predictions of Scripture. Then was fulfilled what was spoken by the prophet in the Psalms, who said, "Praise the Lord from the earth, O dragons, and all the places of the abyss." A reference to the Greek version of Psalm 148, chapter 7. Later on their journey, the family stops to rest under a palm tree, and Jesus' mother, Mary, looks wistfully at the fruit in the high upper branches, wishing there were a way to get some to eat. Joseph upbraids her, since there is obviously no way to climb the tree. But the young Jesus intervenes and orders the tree to bend down to give its precious fruit to his mother, and it does so. Mary eats to her heart's content, and Jesus blesses the tree for its obedience, telling it that, as a reward, one of its branches will be carried to heaven and planted in paradise. Straight away, an angel descends and removes a branch to take it to its new heavenly home. Once the family arrives in Egypt, they have no place to stay, and so they go for shelter into a pagan temple. Inside this temple are 365 idols representing the gods who are to be worshipped, one for each day of the year. But when Jesus enters, the idols all fall over on their faces in obedience to the true divinity in their midst. Once the local ruler learns what has happened, he comes himself and worships the child, telling all his friends and his entire army that now the Lord of all the gods has come into their midst. The Infancy Gospel of Thomas. At roughly the time the Proto-Gospel of James was starting to circulate, another fabricated account of Jesus appeared, today known as the Infancy Gospel of Thomas. Driving this narrative is a question that has been asked by numerous Christians throughout the ages. If Jesus was the miracle-working Son of God as an adult, what was he like as a child? The Infancy Gospel contains stories about Jesus between the ages of 5 and 12. The account begins with Jesus as a 5-year-old playing by a stream near his home in Nazareth. The young Jesus gathers some of the water of the stream into a pool and orders it to become pure. And it does so by his word alone. Jesus then stoops down and forms 12 birds out of the mud. A Jewish man who is walking by becomes upset because it is the Sabbath and Jesus has violated the law by working. The man heads off to tell Joseph what his son has done, and Joseph rushes to the stream to upbraid the boy for breaking the Sabbath. In response, Jesus claps his hands and cries out to the birds to come to life and fly away, and they do so. Here, Jesus is shown to be above the law and to be the Lord of life. Beyond that, he has gotten off the hook with his father by destroying, in effect, any incriminating evidence. Mud birds? What birds? Another child who is playing beside Jesus takes a branch and scatters the water he has carefully gathered together. This angers the young Jesus, who tells the boy, "You unrighteous, irreverent idiot! What did the pools of water do to harm you? See now, you also will be withered like a tree, and you will never bear leaves or root or fruit." The child immediately withers on the spot. In the next story, Jesus is said to be walking through his village when another child runs up to him and accidentally bumps him on the shoulder. Jesus is irritated and says to the boy, "You'll go no farther on your way." And the child falls down dead. The parents of the boy carry him off with some harsh words for Joseph. "Since you have such a child, you cannot live with us in the village, or teach him to bless and not to curse, for he is killing our children." Eventually, Joseph decides that Jesus needs to receive an education, and on 3 occasions, he sends him off to teachers who try to instruct him, but to no effect. In one instance, the teacher tries to teach Jesus the alphabet, in Greek, and practices reciting with him. But Jesus will not respond, until finally he says to the teacher, "If you are really a teacher and know the letters well, tell me the power of the alpha, that is, the first letter of the alphabet, and I will tell you the power of the beta, the second letter." The teacher gets angry and smacks Jesus upside the head. Big mistake. Jesus curses him, and he dies on the spot. Joseph takes Jesus back home with instructions to Mary. Do not let him out the door, for those who anger him die. Eventually, however, Jesus starts using his power not to harm, but to help, raising children from the dead, curing his brother James of a deadly snake bite, and proving to be remarkably handy with his miraculous skills around his father's carpenter shop. The account ends with Jesus as a 12-year-old in the temple in Jerusalem, showing his intelligence and spiritual superiority in his discussions with the teachers of the law, a story otherwise known from the Gospel of Luke. It is hard to know what to make of these stories of Jesus the Wunderkind. Some modern readers have thought that they portray Jesus in a very negative light indeed, but it is not clear that early Christian readers would have seen them that way. The stories may have been designed simply as good Christian entertainment, or they may have been serious attempts to show how the miracle-working Son of God was active and filled with divine power even in the early years, long before his public ministry. Fabrications within the canon. It should not be thought that Christians started fabricating stories about Jesus only after the New Testament was completed. In fact, there can be little doubt that some accounts were manufactured in the early years of the Christian movement. Some of these fabrications made their way into the New Testament. We could go to great lengths to talk about New Testament narratives that purport to present historical events, but are in fact invented stories. Such narratives can be found among the stories about Jesus' birth, life, teachings, death, and resurrection, as well as in stories about his followers, such as Peter and Paul, after his death in the book of Acts. With regard to the stories of Jesus' birth, one does not need to wait for the later Gospels, mentioned above, to begin seeing the fabricated accounts. They are already there in the familiar versions of Matthew and Luke. There never was a census under Caesar Augustus that compelled Joseph and Mary to go to Bethlehem just before Jesus was born. There never was a star that mysteriously guided wise men from the east to Jesus. Herod the Great never did slaughter all the baby boys in Bethlehem. Jesus and his family never did spend several years in Egypt. These may sound like bold and provocative statements, but scholars have known the reasons and evidence behind them for many years. Since I devote considerable attention to them, and to other fabricated accounts of the Gospels, in another recent book, however, I will not go into the details here. It is almost impossible to say whether the people who made up and passed along these stories were comparable to forgers, who knew full well that they were engaged in a kind of deception, or whether they instead were like those who falsely attributed anonymous books to known authors without knowing they were wrong. My guess is that most of the people who told these stories genuinely believed they happened. Even so, we should not say that these storytellers were not involved in deception. They may not have meant to deceive others, or they may have, but they certainly did deceive others. In fact, they deceived others spectacularly well. For many, many centuries, it was simply assumed that the narratives about Jesus and the apostles, narratives both within and outside the New Testament, described events that actually happened. Most readers still read the canonical accounts that way. But many of these stories are not historical narratives. They are, instead, fabricated accounts, whether made up intentionally in order to prove a point, or simply brought into being, somehow, when Christians passed along information about Jesus and those connected to him. Falsifications. In addition to forgery, false attribution, and fabrication, there is another kind of deceptive literary activity that can be called falsification. This occurs whenever someone copies an author's text by hand, but alters it in some way, omitting something, adding something, or just changing the wording. If someone were to copy Paul's first letter to the Corinthians and add a few extra verses that he thought up himself, then the next person to read that manuscript would naturally assume that Paul himself had written the inserted words. That is very similar to what happens with forgery. Someone writes down his own words but attributes them to someone else. In this case, however, rather than composing an entire document in someone else's name, a copyist has written a portion of a document and included it in the other person's book. The practice of altering texts in the process of copying them happened all the time in antiquity. In a world without electronic means of publication, photocopy machines, or even carbon paper, it was well nigh impossible to ensure that any copy of a text would be 100% accurate, without changes of any kind. This is true for all books copied in the ancient world. That is why, when great kings wanted to start significant libraries in their cities, they were sometimes willing to pay sizable amounts of money for originals of the great classics. You could never be sure if copies would be completely true to the original. All of the early Christian writings were, necessarily, susceptible to the vicissitudes of copying. We don't have any original copies of any books of the New Testament, or of any other early Christian book. What we have are copies that have been made from copies of the copies of the copies. In most instances, our earliest complete copies are from centuries after the originals. Just about every copyist made mistakes in copying. As a result, if you were to copy a copy of an original, in most instances, you would copy not just the words of the original, but also the mistakes your predecessor made in copying the original. And whoever came after you and copied your copy would reproduce both your mistakes and the mistakes of your predecessor, as well as introduce some mistakes of her own. And so it goes, year after year, century after century. The only time mistakes are removed is when a copyist realizes that a predecessor had copied something incorrectly and then tries to correct the mistake. The problem is that there is no way to know whether the copyist corrects the mistake correctly or not. He may also correct it incorrectly. That is, change it to something that is different from both the copy he is copying and from the original that was first copied. The possibilities are endless. We do not need to speculate that Christian scribes altered the texts they copied. You can take any book of early Christianity and compare the surviving copies, whether it is a book from the New Testament, say, one of the Gospels or Paul's letters, or a book from outside the New Testament, say, the Infancy Gospel of Thomas or the Epistle of Barnabas. The copies will all differ, often in lots of minor insignificant ways, and sometimes in big ways. In the vast majority of the cases, the changes that copyists made were simply an accident. The slip of a pen, the misspelling of a word, the accidental omission of a word or a line. Sometimes, though, scribes changed their texts because they wanted to do so, either because they thought their scribal predecessors made a mistake that needed to be corrected, or because they wanted to add something to the text, or take away something or change something. As I've indicated, this kind of falsification is close to forgery. It is one author passing off his own words as the words of a respected authority. I have talked about these kinds of changes in a couple of my earlier books and don't want to belabor the point here. Instead, I simply give a few examples of the kind of thing I mean from the pages of the New Testament. In chapter 5, I talked about the famous story found in later manuscripts of the Gospel of John about the woman who was caught in the act of adultery and brought to Jesus for judgment. This is the account in which Jesus delivers one of his most famous sayings: "Let the one without sin among you be the first to cast a stone at her." The story, however, is not found in the oldest manuscripts of the Gospel of John. Moreover, the writing style, in the Greek, is significantly different from the writing style of the rest of the Gospel. In addition, the story breaks the flow of the narrative of John chapters 7 through 8 where it is found. In other words, if you take the story out of John, the context makes much better sense, as the story immediately before the account flows better directly into the story immediately after it. For these and numerous other reasons, there is virtually no debate among New Testament scholars that this story, as wonderful, powerful, and influential as it is, was not originally part of the New Testament. It was added by a scribe. In this instance, we are dealing with both a falsification of the text, making it say something different from what it originally said, and a fabrication, since it is a story that has been made up. There are many other instances of this kind of thing in the surviving manuscripts of the New Testament. Another famous example occurs at the end of the Gospel of Mark. It is sometimes said by people who have not read the concluding chapter of Mark's Gospel closely enough that it lacks a resurrection narrative. Strictly speaking, that is not true. In Mark's Gospel, Jesus is certainly raised from the dead. The women go to the tomb 3 days after he was buried in order to give his body a proper burial, but the body is not there. Instead, there is a man in the tomb who informs them that Jesus has been raised from the dead. Mark, therefore, believes that Jesus was physically raised from the dead, and he tells his readers as much. But what is most astonishing is what happens next. The man at the tomb instructs the women to go to the disciples and tell them that Jesus will go before them to Galilee and that they are to meet him there. But instead of telling the disciples, the women fled from the tomb, and they did not say anything to anyone, for they were afraid. Chapter 16, verse 8. And that's where the gospel ends. There is definitely a resurrection of Jesus here, but the disciples never learn of it, and there is no account of Jesus' meeting with any of them. The ending is brilliant. It brings readers up short and makes them say, "What? How could the women not tell anyone? How could no one learn of Jesus' resurrection? How could Jesus not appear to anyone afterwards? That's it? That's the end? How could that be the end?" Scribes felt the same way. And different scribes added different endings to the gospel. The ending that became the most popular throughout the Middle Ages was found in the manuscripts used by the translators of the King James Version in 1611, so that it became widely familiar to English Bible readers. In an additional 12 verses, the women, or at least Mary Magdalene, do go tell the disciples, who do then see Jesus and become convinced he has been raised. It is in these verses that we find the famous words of Jesus that those who believe in him will be able to speak in foreign tongues, pick up serpents, and drink poison without suffering any harm. But Jesus never said these words, and Mark never claimed he did. They were added to Mark by a later scribe and then recopied over the years. This is a fabricated story that has been put into the Bible by a copyist who falsified the text. There are hundreds of significant changes in the manuscripts of the New Testament, but let me here just mention one other. In the previous examples, one could argue that the falsifications were not exactly the same as forgeries, since both John from the first example and Mark from the second were written anonymously. Technically speaking, the scribes who changed the texts were not saying their words came from the pen of a known authority figure. I would dispute that claim, I think, because by the time the scribes made these changes, it was widely thought that the fourth gospel was in fact by John and the second by Mark. But there is no ambiguity about my final example, since it involves one of the undisputed letters of Paul. One of the most hurtful passages for the cause of women who want to be active in the Christian church occurs in 1 Corinthians, chapter 14, verses 34 through 35. Here, Paul is recorded as saying, "Let the women in the churches keep silent, for it is not permitted for them to speak. Instead, let them be submissive, just as the law itself says. If they wish to learn anything, let them ask their own husbands at home, for it is shameful for a woman to speak in church." Women are to be silent and submissive to their husbands. They are not to speak at all in church. This obviously makes it impossible for a woman to utter a prophecy in church, pray publicly and openly in church, or teach in church. Women are not allowed even to ask a question in church. These verses are very much like what one reads in one of the Pauline letters that is not authentic, 1 Timothy, which, as we saw in chapter 3, also indicates that women are to be subject to men and not to exercise any authority over them, chapter 2, verses 11 through 15. But just as 1 Timothy is forged, so too has this passage in 1 Corinthians been falsified. These verses in chapter 14 were not written by Paul. Someone added them to the passage later, after the letter had been placed in circulation. Scholars have adduced many reasons for this view. For one thing, the verses seem to intrude in the passage in which they are found. Immediately before these verses, Paul is talking about prophecy in the church. Immediately afterwards, he is talking about prophecy. But this passage on women interrupts the flow of the argument. Take them out, and it flows much better. Even more, it is hard to believe that Paul would tell women that they could not speak in church here in 1 Corinthians 14, when just three chapters earlier he indicated that they could indeed do so. In 1 Corinthians 11, Paul urges women who pray and prophesy in church to do so only with veils on their heads. If they were allowed to speak in chapter 11, how could they be told not to speak in chapter 14? It makes better sense that those scholars are right who think that the verses were not originally part of the text of 1 Corinthians. Someone has falsified the book by adding the verses to it, making the passage say what these copyists wanted it to say, rather than allowing Paul to say what he meant to say. Plagiarism. Plagiarism involves taking someone else's writing and passing it off as your own. As I indicated at the outset of this chapter, it has become an increasingly serious problem on college campuses. Techniques of plagiarism have improved through the use of the internet, and it is oh so easy to find lots of things written about lots of topics, if not complete essays of approximately the same length as your required term paper, at least chunks of writing that are easily copied into a paper at a critical point. Luckily, methods of detection of plagiarism have improved with advances in technology, as many professors now use sophisticated software designed to identify it. The penalties for being caught can be harsh. At my university, anyone detected and convicted of plagiarism is dismissed from school. Not for a day or two, but permanently. It is sometimes claimed by scholars that plagiarism is a modern phenomenon without ancient corollary. Some years ago, for example, there appeared an influential and popular book called The Five Gospels, put out by a team of scholars from the Jesus Seminar. This book represented the results of the labor of many years, in which scholars worked to decide which of the sayings in the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and Thomas actually go back to the historical Jesus. Sayings that Jesus really said, in the opinion of these scholars, were printed in red. Sayings that were relatively close to something he said were printed in pink. Sayings that were not really like something he said were in gray, and sayings that he absolutely did not say were in black. Most of the sayings in the Gospels were in gray and black. This incensed a lot of people. A number of scholars who were not involved in the project, however, were more concerned by which sayings were in black. In my opinion, the members of the Jesus Seminar typically got precisely wrong what Jesus actually said. Apart from that, the volume contains at least one statement that scholars would call a howler, a mistake so outrageous that the scholars who produced it should have known better. This is in the introduction to the book, where it states, "The concept of plagiarism was unknown in the ancient world." I don't know how anyone who has actually gone to the trouble of reading the ancient sources could say such a thing. It is flat out wrong. Ancient authors knew all about plagiarism, and they condemned it as a deceptive practice. For starters, consider the words of Vitruvius, a famous Roman architect and engineer of the 1st century BCE, in Book 7 of his 10-volume work on architecture. "We are bound to censure those who, borrowing from others, publish as their own that of which they are not the authors." Or take the comments of Polybius, one of the great historians of the ancient Greek world, writing 100 years earlier, who reports that historians near his own time who have stolen the writings of ancient historians and passed them off as their own have behaved in a most shameful manner. Those who do so engage in a most disgraceful proceeding. Some authors were incensed when their own works were plagiarized. On several occasions, the witty Roman poet Martial upbraided others for stealing his writings and copying them out under their own name, as if they had composed them. "You mistake, you greedy thief of my works, who think you can become a poet at no more than the cost of a transcript in a cheap papyrus roll. Applause is not acquired for 6 or 10 sesterces. In a number of places, the historian of philosophy, Diogenes Laertius, speaks of philosophers and literary authors who tried to pass off the works of others as their own, stealing them and publishing them as if they themselves had written them. This was true, he indicates, of a disciple of Socrates named Aeschines, who took several of Socrates' dialogues from his widow and claimed that they were his own compositions. It was also true of Heraclides, whom we met in chapter 1, who stole an essay from another scholar about the ancient Homer and Hesiod and published it as his own. And it was true of the philosopher Empedocles, who was excluded from attending the lectures of the famous 6th century BCE Pythagoras because he was convicted at that time of stealing his discourses. Like forgery, plagiarism is deceptive because it intends to lead readers astray. But, in another sense, plagiarism can be seen as the flip side of forgery. Forgers write their own words and claim they are the words of another. Plagiarists take the words of another and claim they are their own. It is an interesting question whether ancient scholars would have accused some of the early Christian writers of plagiarism. The issues tend to be complicated by the fact that possible instances of plagiarism involve borrowed texts that are anonymous. Moreover, the plagiarists themselves often do not actually identify themselves by name, but are either anonymous or claim to be someone else. Can a forger plagiarize? Maybe so. If so, what are we to say of the book of 2 Peter? Scholars have long recognized that chapter 2 and the beginning of chapter 3 sound very much like the book of Jude in its vitriolic attack on false and highly immoral persons who have infiltrated the Christian church. Very close similarities exist between Jude, chapters 4 through 13, chapters 16 through 18, and 2 Peter, chapter 2, verses 1 through 18, chapter 3, verses 1 through 3. There are not many extensive, exact verbal repetitions, but they share many of the same ideas, thoughts, and often words. If a modern student simply rewrote a text by changing many of the words but keeping all the ideas, without acknowledging her source, she could well be considered to have plagiarized. But perhaps the issue is not so clear-cut in this case. What, then, about the Gospels? Scholars since the 19th century have argued that the reason Matthew, Mark, and Luke are so much alike, telling many of the same stories, usually in the same sequence, often in precisely the same words, is that they used the same sources. In fact, it is everywhere recognized today that one of them was a source for the other two. Almost all scholars think that Mark was used by Matthew and Luke. Some scholars continued to hold to the view that Matthew was the source for Mark and Luke. But that is very much a minority position. In either case, we have one document that is taken over by others, frequently verbatim. It is true that none of the authors names himself. To that extent, the later authors are not, strictly speaking, plagiarizing, in that they are not publishing someone else's work under their own name, but they are taking over someone else's work and publishing it as their own. Ancient scholars who spoke about this phenomenon would have called this stealing. In modern parlance, it is perhaps best to call it a kind of plagiarism. There are other instances of the phenomenon from outside the New Testament. I mentioned earlier in this chapter, for example, that the Gospel of Pseudo-Matthew takes over the narrative of the Proto-Gospel of James, publishing it in an edited form, sometimes heavily edited, but in other places hardly edited at all, without acknowledging where the story came from. This is comparable in many ways to what the authors of the New Testament Gospels of Matthew and Luke did with Mark. Another book I mentioned in chapter 1, the Apostolic Constitutions, is even more flagrant, taking over virtually wholesale three documents from earlier times: the Didache, from around the year 100, the Apostolic Tradition, from the late 2nd century, and the Didascalia, from the 3rd, combining them together into one large document and publishing it as if it had been information handed down directly from the apostles. But it was not. It was taken over, stolen, to use the ancient parlance, from earlier writings of the Christian tradition. Conclusion. What can we say in conclusion about the forms of deception we have considered in this chapter? False attributions, fabrications, falsifications, plagiarism. They all, indeed, involve deceptive practices. Readers who read books that had been wrongly ascribed to apostles or their companions, or that contain stories that were made up, or that presented texts that had been altered by scribes, or that contained passages or entire accounts that were stolen from the writings of earlier authors without acknowledgement, readers of all such statements were deceived in one way or another. Some were deceived into thinking that what they read was really composed by the people claimed as their authors. Others were misled to think that the historical events that were narrated were actual historical occurrences. In every case, they were wrong. They had been deceived. Just as people continue to be deceived when they think, for example, that the tax collector Matthew wrote the first gospel, that Paul told women that they had to be silent in church, or that the author of 2 Peter came up with the ideas and phrases found in his second chapter himself. One key aspect of forgery, however, does not appear to be involved in every instance of these other forms of deception. Forgery, almost always, involves a flat-out lie. Forgers claim to be someone else, knowing full well their own real identity. That is not always the case with the comparable phenomena I have been discussing here. Sometimes anonymous works were simply attributed to people who were thought to have written them, and it was all a mistake. Sometimes, possibly, stories were innocently fabricated, just as historically inaccurate stories are made up all the time, without any intention to deceive. Sometimes scribes altered the texts they were copying by accident, without meaning to do so. But other instances probably involved a good deal of intentionality. A theologian who wanted to convince his opponents that his views were those of the apostles may well have claimed that the fourth gospel was written by John without knowing if that was true or not. A storyteller who made up an account about Jesus in order to prove a point may well have known that he was passing off a fiction as a historical event. A scribe who wanted a text to say something other than what it did may well have changed the text for just that reason. In some cases, it is hard to imagine how else the resultant deception could have come about. Whoever added the final 12 verses of Mark did not do so by a mere slip of the pen. In sum, there were numerous ways to lie in and through literature in antiquity, and some Christians took advantage of the full panoply in their efforts to promote their view of the faith. It may seem odd to modern readers, or even counterintuitive, that a religion that built its reputation on possessing the truth had members who attempted to disseminate their understanding of the truth through deceptive means. But it is precisely what happened. The use of deception to promote the truth may well be considered one of the most unsettling ironies of the early Christian tradition. Chapter 8. Forgeries, lies, deceptions, and the writings of the New Testament. When I give public talks about the books that did not make it into the New Testament, people often ask me about apocryphal tales they have heard. What do we know about the lost years of Jesus, that gap of time between when he was 12 and 30? Is it true that he went to India to study with the Brahmins? Was Jesus an Essene? Don't we have a death warrant from Pontius Pilate ordering Jesus' execution? And so on. Very few of the apocryphal stories that people hear today come from the ancient forgeries I have been examining in this book. Instead, they come from modern forgeries that claim to represent historical facts kept from the public by scholars or the Vatican. The real facts, however, are that these mysterious accounts have uniformly been exposed as fabrications perpetrated by well-meaning or mischievous writers of the 19th and 20th centuries. Their exposure, however, has done little to stop laypeople from believing them. Modern forgeries, lies, and deceptions. I discuss four modern forgeries here, just to give you a taste of the kinds of things that have been widely read. All four, and many others, are discussed and demolished in two interesting books by bona fide scholars of Christian antiquity. Edgar Goodspeed, a prominent American New Testament scholar of the mid-20th century, and Per Beskow, a Swedish scholar of early Christianity writing in the 1970s. The Unknown Life of Jesus Christ. One of the most widely disseminated modern forgeries is called The Unknown Life of Jesus Christ. From this account, we learn that Jesus went to India during his formative teen years, the lost years before his public ministry, and there learned the secrets of the East. The book made a big splash when it appeared in English in 1926, but as it turns out, it had already been exposed as a fraud more than 30 years earlier. The reading public, it is safe to say, has a short attention span. The book was first published in France in 1894 as La Vie Inconnue de Jésus-Christ by a Russian war correspondent named Nicholas Notovich. Almost immediately it was widely disseminated and translated. In 1 year it appeared in 8 editions in French, with translations into German, Spanish, and Italian. One edition was published in the United Kingdom, and 3 separate editions in the United States. The book consisted of 244 paragraphs arranged in 14 chapters. Notovich starts the book by explaining how he discovered it. In 1887, he was allegedly traveling in India and Kashmir when he heard from the lamas of Tibet stories about a prophet named Isa, the Arabic form, roughly, of the name Jesus. His further travels took him to the district of Ladakh, on the border between India and Tibet, to the famous Tibetan Buddhist monastery of Hemis. While there, he heard additional stories and was told that written records of the life of Aisa still survived. Notovitch left the monastery without learning anything further. But after a couple of days, he had a bad accident, falling off his horse and breaking his leg. He was carried back to the monastery to recuperate, and while there, came to be on friendly terms with the abbot. When Notovitch inquired about the stories of Aisa, the abbot agreed to give him the full account. He produced two thick volumes written in Tibetan and began to read them out loud to Notovitch, in the presence of a translator who explained what the text said, while Notovitch took notes. The Unknown Life of Jesus Christ is the published edition of the careful notes that Notovitch allegedly took. When Jesus was 13, according to the account, he joined a caravan of merchants to go to India to study their sacred laws. He spent 6 years with the Brahmins learning their holy books, the Vedas. But Jesus was completely disenchanted with the Indian caste system and openly began to condemn it. This raised the ire of the Brahmins, who decided to put him to death. Jesus fled to join a community of Buddhists, from whom he learned Pali, the language of Theravada Buddhism, and mastered the Buddhist texts. He next visited Persia and preached to the Zoroastrians. Finally, as a 29-year-old, armed with all the sacred knowledge of the East, he returned to Palestine and began his public ministry. The narrative concludes by summarizing his words and deeds and giving a brief account of his death. The story of his life was then allegedly taken by Jewish merchants back to India, where those who had known Aisa as a young man realized it was the same person. They then wrote down the full account. Although the narrative of The Unknown Life of Jesus Christ may sound like a rather second-rate novel, it was published as a historically factual account and was widely believed as providing the key to the questions that Christians had long asked about the lost years of Jesus. What was he doing then? And how had he acquired such extensive and compelling religious knowledge before beginning his public ministry? It was not long, however, before scholars interested in historical fact began to question the account and to expose it as a complete hoax. The tale was taken on by no less eminent an authority than Max Müller, the greatest European scholar of Indian culture of the late 19th century, who showed that the tale of the discovery of the book and the stories it told were filled with insurmountable implausibilities. If this great book was a favorite at the monastery of Hemis, why is it not found in either of the comprehensive catalogs of Tibetan literature? How is it that the Jewish merchants who went to India with tales of Jesus happened to meet up with precisely the Brahmins who knew Aisa as a young man, out of the millions of people in India? And how did Aisa's former associates in India realize exactly that the crucified man was their former student? In 1894, an Englishwoman who had read The Unknown Life visited Hemis Monastery. She made inquiries and learned that no Russian had ever been there. No one had been nursed back to health after breaking his leg, and they had no books describing the life of Aisa. The next year, a scholar, J. Archibald Douglas, went and interviewed the abbot himself, who informed him that there had been no European with a broken leg in the monastery during his 15 years in charge of the community. Moreover, he had been a lama for 42 years and was well acquainted with Buddhist literature. Not only did he never read aloud a book about Aisa to a European or to anyone else, he was certain that no such book as The Unknown Life existed in Tibet. Additional internal implausibilities and inaccuracies of the story are exposed by both Goodspeed and Besko. Today, there is not a single recognized scholar on the planet who has any doubts about the matter. The entire story was invented by Notovitch, who earned a good deal of money and a substantial amount of notoriety for his hoax. The Crucifixion of Jesus by an Eyewitness. An equally interesting modern apocryphon, The Crucifixion of Jesus by an Eyewitness, deals not with the beginning of Jesus' adult life before his ministry, but with its ending and aftermath. The account comes in the form of a letter, written in Latin, 7 years after Jesus' crucifixion, from a leader of the mysterious Jewish sect of the Essenes in Jerusalem to another Essene leader who lived in Alexandria, Egypt. All elements of the supernatural are completely stripped away from the account's description of Jesus' life and death. Jesus is shown to have led a completely human life and to have died a completely human death, but not on the cross. Jesus survived his own crucifixion and lived for another 6 months. The account was first published in German in Leipzig in 1849. English editions, all claiming to be authentic, were published in 1907, 1919, and 1975. There were also translations into French and Swedish. The Latin letter was allegedly discovered on a parchment scroll in an old Greek monastery in Alexandria by a missionary who thought that its message was dangerous and so tried to destroy it. It was saved, however, by a learned Frenchman who translated the account into German. The narrative was then brought to Germany by the Freemasons, understood to be modern-day descendants of the Essenes. According to the account, Jesus himself was an Essene. When he was crucified, according to this eyewitness, he did not expire. He was taken from the cross and restored to life by Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus, fellow Essenes, who knew the secret arts of healing preserved by the sect. When the women visiting the tomb thought they saw angels, these were Essene monks wearing their white robes. The women misunderstood that Jesus had been raised when in fact he had never died. He did die, however, 6 months later, from the wounds he had sustained. It has not been difficult for scholars to expose this gospel as another fraud. The eyewitness, allegedly an Essene, has no understanding of what the Essenes were really like. Today we know a good deal about this Jewish group, thanks to the Dead Sea Scrolls, which were unavailable to the forger since they were discovered nearly a century after he produced his account. Nothing in the story corresponds to the historical realities of the group. For one thing, there was no way an Essene in Jerusalem would write his account in Latin, of all things. There are other considerable problems. The account indicates that it was written 7 years after the crucifixion, yet it explicitly mentions, by name, the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, which were not written until 40 to 60 years after Jesus' death. Moreover, these books were not known as a group of writings, the four Gospels, until the end of the second century. Finally, the exclusion of everything supernatural in the account is a thoroughly modern, post-Enlightenment concern, not an ancient one. And in fact, a modern scholar has shown where this concern, and indeed the entire story, came from. In 1936, a famous German scholar of the New Testament, Martin Debelius, demonstrated that the crucifixion of Jesus was virtually lifted wholesale from a now rather obscure work of historical fiction written by the German rationalist H. K. Venturini, The Natural History of the Great Prophet of Nazareth, 2 volumes, 1800 through 1802. Here, too, Jesus was an Essene whose life had nothing supernatural about it and who did not actually die on the cross but was revived by Joseph of Arimathea. The author of The Crucifixion of Jesus simply took Venturini's 2-volume work, condensed it into a readable booklet, and tried to pass it off as a historical account, when in fact, it was a modern fabrication. The death sentence of Jesus Christ. One of the striking, and to many people, surprising facts about the first century is that we don't have any Roman records of any kind that attest to the existence of Jesus. We have no birth certificate, no references to his words or deeds, no accounts of his trial, no descriptions of his death, no reference to him whatsoever in any way, shape, or form. Jesus' name is not even mentioned in any Roman source of the first century. This does not mean, as is now being claimed with alarming regularity, that Jesus never existed. He certainly existed, as virtually every competent scholar of antiquity, Christian or non-Christian, agrees, based on clear and certain evidence. But as with the vast majority of all persons who lived and died in the first century, he does not appear in the records of the Roman people. That is why the alleged discovery of an official copy of Pilate's death sentence made such an enormous impact in Europe and the United States when it was announced in the mid-19th century. The discovery was first mentioned in the French paper Le Droit in the spring of 1839. It was soon exposed as a fraud, but it resurfaced again in Germany 10 years later and repeatedly elsewhere, including the United States, for many decades afterward. The death sentence was allegedly found on a copper plate discovered in the southern Italian city of Aquila, near Naples, all the way back in 1820. A group of workers was said to have been excavating for Roman antiquities when they uncovered an ancient marble vase. Inside the vase was a copper plate inscribed in Hebrew. When the text was translated, it was found to contain an official copy of Jesus' death warrant issued by Pontius Pilate. On the reverse side were directions for the warrant to be sent to all the tribes of Israel. The plate allegedly came to be lost, but it was rediscovered during the French occupation of the Kingdom of Naples in 1806-15. When it was published a couple of decades later, it was touted as the most impressive legal document in existence. In it, Pontius Pilate, the acting governor of Lower Galilee, states that Jesus of Nazareth shall suffer death on the cross. This is said to have happened in the 17th year of the reign of the Emperor Tiberius, 31 CE, on March 27th, in the most holy city of Jerusalem. The reason for the death sentence was that Jesus had committed 6 crimes. He was a seducer, he was seditious, he was an enemy of the law, he falsely called himself the Son of God, he called himself the King of Israel, and he entered the temple followed by a multitude carrying palm branches. The death warrant is signed by 4 witnesses: Daniel Robani, Johannes Robani, Raphael Robani, and Capet, a citizen. A top-flight scholar such as Edgar Goodspeed had no difficulty exposing the entire document as a hoax. It made no sense for a Roman official to try to justify his conviction of a criminal to the Jewish people, or to send the justification to the tribes of Israel, which had not in fact existed for many centuries. Pilate, a Roman official, would not have written in Hebrew, a language he didn't know. Pilate was not the governor of Lower Galilee, but of Judea. As a non-Jew, he never would have referred to Jerusalem as the most holy city. March 27th is a modern form of dating unknown to the ancient world. The term Rabbani, used for 3 of the witnesses, appears to be a mistaken form of Rabban, which means teacher. The author probably made the mistake because in direct address, such as in John chapter 20, verse 16, the word is spelled R-A-B-B-O-U-N-I. Johannes is not an ancient name in any of the relevant languages. Capet is a French name, and there is no Hebrew word for citizen. There are more problems, but these are enough to illustrate the case. Whoever made this account up did a rather poor job of it, even though his hoax had wide success in both Europe and the United States for over a century. The long-lost second book of Acts. In 1904, the Anglican priest and physician Kenneth Sylvan Guthrie published a book called The Long-Lost Sacred Book of Acts, which, among other things, describes the teachings of Mary, the mother of Jesus, about reincarnation. It is called the Second Book of Acts because it begins by describing what happened to the Apostle Paul after the events narrated in the New Testament Book of Acts. After being released from his Roman imprisonment, mentioned in Acts 28, Paul allegedly planned to go to Spain and then to Britain. But he eventually decides, instead, to go to Palestine. When he arrives, he goes to Jerusalem to the house of the disciple John, where he finds Mary, the mother of Jesus, along with 7 of the disciples. An elderly woman now, Mary prays for her death, and the angel Gabriel appears to tell her that her prayer is to be answered. From her deathbed, reflecting on her mortality, Mary then divulges the secret doctrine of reincarnation. She herself has gone through 7 incarnations. Among other things, she has been the wife of Noah, the woman who loved Zarathustra, the one who loved Siddhartha, and later still, the one who loved Socrates. Just before her death, a storm comes, and Mary leads the disciples off to the Mount of Olives. Jesus appears from heaven and takes her in his arms. He tells the disciples that he too has had several previous incarnations, as Abel, Noah, Zarathustra, and Socrates. This book is so obviously a fiction that it is hard to imagine its author expecting anyone to take it seriously. But given the reading public, who knows? Goodspeed, at any rate, thought that it was simply a modern effort to claim that the Virgin Mary and Jesus himself endorsed the doctrine of reincarnation, and that Guthrie doubtless thought it so transparent a device that it would deceive nobody. Other hoaxes and deceptions. There are, of course, many other modern apocrypha that try to report on what Jesus and those associated with him really did. A book called The Confession of Pontius Pilate tells the story of Pilate going into exile in Vienna, where he feels deep remorse for what he did to Jesus and eventually commits suicide. Among other things, this account refers to a story in which Mary Magdalene presents the Roman Emperor Tiberius with an Easter egg dyed red. In The Gospel of the Holy Twelve, Jesus is said to espouse a strictly vegetarian view in opposition to those who kill and eat animals. In this inventive narrative, Jesus is said not to have eaten lamb at the Passover and to have fed the multitudes not with 5 loaves and 2 fish, but with 5 melons. One could argue that hoaxes are created not only by obscure figures trying to sensationalize accounts of Jesus, Jesus studied with the Brahmins, or to authenticate their particular worldviews, Jesus was a vegetarian, but also by scholars who may have had obscure reasons of their own. One of the wildly popular books about Jesus during the 1960s and 1970s was Hugh Schoenfield's The Passover Plot, A New Interpretation of the Life and Death of Jesus. Schoenfield was a brilliant and widely acknowledged scholar of ancient Judaism with a complete set of bona fide credentials. But his historical reconstruction of what really happened to Jesus reads more like a Hollywood production than serious scholarship. The short story is that Jesus, from an early age, knew that he was the Messiah, and so manipulated events during his public ministry to make it appear that he was fulfilling prophecy. In particular, he plotted with his disciples to feign his own death for the sins of others. He arranged to be drugged on the cross. When he was given the gall and vinegar, it was medicinal, so that his vital signs would slow down and he would appear to be dead. He would then be revived and appear to have been raised from the dead. The plot failed, however. Jesus had not counted on a Roman soldier spearing him in the side on the cross. He revived only briefly and was removed from the tomb by prior arrangement with co-conspirators, not the disciples. He died of his wounds soon thereafter and was reburied elsewhere. The disciples, however, discovered the empty tomb and mistakenly thought they saw Jesus alive afterwards. They then proclaimed that he had been raised from the dead, and thus started Christianity. The Passover plot is not a forgery, of course. The author of the account, who writes in his own name, is a serious historian and lets his readers know it. And it is not exactly a fabrication, in that he claims that he is basing his account on historical research. Moreover, he presents it as a historical study. But as creative as it is, the major premise of the account is completely made up. There is no historical truth to it. As a final example, I might mention, again, the case involving one of the 20th century's truly eminent scholars of early Christianity, Columbia professor Morton Smith. Smith claimed to have discovered a lost, alternate version of the Gospel of Mark. The account of the discovery appeared in 2 books Smith published in 1973. One, a detective-like narrative for popular audiences, and the other, an erudite, hard-hitting research monograph for scholars. In them, Smith stated that in 1958, while visiting a monastery near Jerusalem, he discovered a handwritten copy of a letter, in Greek, by a second-century church father, Clement of Alexandria, in which he claimed that the author of Mark had published a second edition of his gospel. This secret gospel, as it came to be known, included a couple of stories not found in Mark, stories that sound mysterious and strange, about Jesus and his relationship with the young man he had raised from the dead. Smith argued that this relationship was homosexual, and that it provided evidence that Jesus had engaged in sexual activities with the naked men that he baptized during his ministry. Needless to say, Smith's books caused quite a stir. His scholarly book provided serious evidence that this really was a letter from Clement of Alexandria, and that Clement really did know of such a gospel. But since Smith's death in 1991, a number of scholars have come forward to argue that the letter is not authentic, that it was forged by none other than Smith himself. Two books have been published on the matter in recent years, both coming to the same conclusion but on different grounds. Other scholars, including those who knew Smith well, do not think so, and the debate goes on. Christian forgeries, lies, and deceptions. This issue of modern hoaxes brings me back to a question I have repeatedly asked in my study of forgeries. Who would do such a thing? I hope by now you will agree with my earlier answer. Lots of people. And for lots of reasons. And not just modern people. We have instances of Christian forgeries not only today, but also in the Middle Ages, in late antiquity, and in the time of the New Testament. From the 1st century to the 21st century, people who have called themselves Christian have seen fit to fabricate, falsify, and forge documents, in most instances, in order to authorize views they wanted others to accept. My particular interest in this book, of course, is with the forgeries of the early Christian church. No one doubts that there were lots of them. Today we have only a fraction of the ones that were produced in antiquity, as the vast majority of them have been lost or destroyed. But what we have is more than enough to give us a sense of how prominent the practice of forgery was. We have numerous gospels, letters, treatises, and apocalypses that claim to be written by people who did not write them. The authors who called themselves Peter, Paul, John, James, Philip, Thomas, or pick your name, knew full well they were not these people. They lied about it in order to deceive their readers into thinking they were authority figures. Some of these writings made it into the Bible. There are New Testament letters claiming to be written by Peter and Paul, for example, and James and Jude. But these books were written by other, unknown authors, living after the apostles themselves had died. When the real authors of these books claimed to be apostles, they were consciously involved in deception. This practice was widely talked about in the ancient world and was almost always condemned as lying, illegitimate, and just plain wrong. But authors did it anyway. I'm not saying that the authors who engaged in this activity were necessarily violating the dictates of their own conscience. We have no way of knowing what they really thought about themselves or about what they were doing. All we know is that when ancient people talked about the practice, they did not say positive things about it. Books that were forged were called false and illegitimate. But one can imagine that the authors themselves may not have seen it this way. Whenever we have a record of those being caught in the act, they try to justify what they did. The second century author who fabricated the story of Paul and Thecla, mentioned earlier, claimed he did it out of love for Paul. The 5th century forger, Salvian of Marseille, claimed he thought no one would think he meant it when he called himself Timothy, and that he didn't mean any harm by it. And after all, no one would take seriously a book written by Salvian, whereas a book by Timothy might be widely read. See chapter 1. It is possible that many of the authors whose works we have considered, both within and outside of the New Testament, felt completely justified in what they were doing. If so, they were accepting the ancient view, held by many people still today, that lying is the right thing to do in some instances, as mentioned in chapter 1. In the ancient world, this view was based on the idea that there could be such a thing as a noble lie, a lie that serves a noble cause. If a doctor needs to lie to a patient in order to get her to take the medicine she needs, then that can be a good form of deception. If a commander-in-chief needs to lie to his troops that reinforcements are about to arrive in order to inspire them to fight more courageously, then that can be a good thing. Some lies are noble. Other Christian authors, most notably Augustine, took precisely the opposite line, arguing that lying in all its forms was bad. Very bad. Very, very bad. It was not to be engaged in, no matter what. For Augustine, even if a lie could guarantee that your young daughter would not spend eternity in the fires of hell, but would enjoy the eternal bliss of heaven, that was not enough to justify telling the lie. You should never lie. Period. Most early Christians probably disagreed with Augustine, which is why he had to argue his point so strenuously. And most people today probably disagree as well. Most of us see lying as a complicated matter. Ethicists, philosophers, and religious scholars all disagree, even today, on when lying is appropriate and when it is not. At the end of the day, This is a question that each and every one of us needs to decide for ourselves, based on our own circumstances and the specific situations we find ourselves in. Maybe sometimes it is okay to lie. Maybe it is okay for parents to lie to their children about their own religious beliefs, to tell them that God exists, even though they don't actually think so. Maybe it is okay for a spouse to lie to her partner about her extramarital affair, if it will prevent him from going through great turmoil and pain. Maybe it is okay to lie to one's parent about the prognosis after surgery, if it will keep the beloved parent from worrying about dying before their time. Maybe it is okay for church leaders to lie to their congregations about their personal beliefs or their less-than-perfect past, if they have to be seen as respected and stalwart leaders of the community. Maybe it is okay for elected officials to lie about budgets or deficits, shortfalls or windfalls, possible outcomes of policies, foreign intelligence, or the known outcomes of war, if the ends are sufficiently important to require lies instead of the truth. And if lying is justified in some instances, what better reason for lying than to get people to understand and believe the truth? What would make better sense than writing a book that embodies a lie about a relatively unimportant matter, who really wrote this, in order to accomplish what really does matter, the truth being proclaimed? On the other hand, maybe the authors who forged these texts were wrong. Maybe they should not have tried to deceive their readers. Maybe it is better always to tell the truth, to stand by the truth, to be willing to take the consequences of the truth, even if you would much prefer the consequences of telling the lie. Maybe children have the right to know what parents honestly believe. Maybe it is better for a spouse to tell her partner about an extramarital affair, if the alternative is to live a life of deceit and distrust. Maybe a dying parent, or grandparent, sibling, or anyone else, has the right to know that death is imminent, so he or she can prepare for the inevitable. Maybe it is better for church leaders not to mislead their people, but to tell them what they honestly know to be true. For example, about church finances, or about their own sinful past. Or what they honestly believe. For example, about God or the Bible. Maybe it is better for our elected officials to come clean and tell us the truth, rather than mislead us, so as to be authorized to do what they desperately want to do domestically or on foreign soil. Maybe, on the whole, truth is better than lying. To be sure, most people, in most circumstances, present, past, and very distant past, realize that there are times when it might be right and good to lie. If, for example, it can save a life or keep someone from physical harm. But the reality is that most of our lies are not so weighty. Certainly, the lies manufactured by the forgers of early Christian texts were not told in order to protect life and limb. They were told in order to deceive readers into thinking that the authors of these books were established authority figures. If these texts were produced by reliable authorities, then what they say about what to believe and how to live must be true. True teachings were based on lies. At the same time, the authors of these lies were no doubt like nearly everyone else in the world, ancient and modern. They too probably did not want to be lied to and deceived. But for reasons of their own, they felt compelled to lie and deceive others. To this extent, they did not live up to one of the fundamental principles of the Christian tradition, taught by Jesus himself, that you should do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Possibly they felt that, in their circumstances, the golden rule did not apply. If so, it would certainly explain why so many of the writings of the New Testament claim to have been written by apostles, when in fact, they were not. This recording of Forged, Writing in the Name of God, Why the Bible's Authors Are Not Who We Think They Are, by Bart D. Ehrman, was produced and directed by Bob Dion and performed by Walter Dixon. It was recorded, edited, mixed, and mastered by Dion Audio Services, Incorporated. Executive Producer, Karen Jaconsky. Text copyright 2010 by Bart D. Ehrman. Production copyright 2011 by HarperCollins Publishers. We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio. For more information about the broad range of titles from Harper Audio, Harper Children's Audio, and Cadman, please visit harperaudio.com. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.